Today, my guest is Rick Speer, who is a senior partner at Simon Kucher in the financial services practice. Welcome to the podcast, Rick.
Thanks, Mark.
Now, we always start with the same question for everyone. So here it is for you, Rick. Why do you do what you do?
Well, of course, I want to turn that question on its head, which is, what do I do? So that you can understand potentially why I do it. So I'm a management consultant, but I've spent about 50% of my career helping to run companies and 50% of my career advising companies. And so being a management consultant is unique. And it's unique relative to other types of operating roles that you can have, because your operating role is to be an advisor. Most operating roles is to be a doer or decision maker. And in my case, I advise decision makers who then hopefully compel doers to do stuff for them. But I've been in the role of being a decision maker, and I've been in the role of being a doer. And so I think that learning and understanding what those roles mean helped me be a better advisor. And when I think about why I do something, at least partly why I do something, is because I'm pretty good at it. And so I think that the self-reinforcement of having done different roles and understanding what it means to do well in those roles actually makes me a better advisor. So it's a self-reinforcing circle of, virtuous circle for myself.
So you are basically a coach player, because you were a player and you were pretty good at that. And now you coach other people how to play the game. Is that a fair way to say it?
I don't look at what I do as coaching. I mean, I've been a coach. So I'm also a pretty serious athlete. So I've been bicycle racing for many years. And, as a coach, you're sort of living vicariously through your client. You know, and you're prescribing to them, this is your training program, this is your objectives. As an advisor, it's different than being a coach, because as an advisor, you're basically acting as an extension of the company you're advising. So even though you may not be the person who's actually, quote unquote, pedaling the bike, you may not be getting credit for pedaling the bike. You're in there pedaling with them. As a coach, you're really watching the other person perform. As an advisor, you're helping them perform. And so the difference is important. The idea is, like, I have a lot of control over the outcome of every effort that I work with a client. And even though I'm the advisor and they're the decision maker, I have to know that I'm helping them make those right decisions. And making those right decisions, the value that I'm helping to create, is another reason why I enjoy what I do. It's because being closely connected to value, which of course is Simon Kucher's credo, that, you know, we're value creation drivers, is critical to who I think of myself as a professional.
For one thing that you solve for your customers.
Value creation is probably the number one thing that I solve for. It's the number one thing that we solve for as a firm, whether it's helping to make the right acquisition, or it's helping to monetize the value in acquisition fully, or it's taking a product that is doing well and making it, you know, help it do even better. That's the key focus of us as a firm. And for me specifically, I started my career in 1984. So I helped to create something called program trading. I was one of probably 20 guys at Morgan Stanley who invented basically electronic trading. Right. And what an incredible cast of people that I was surrounded with. I was one of the more junior people on the team. We helped to invent something. And Morgan Stanley took the lead for many years in terms of electronic trading and program trading as a result. And so my background is capital markets, asset management, and wealth management. And I advise both key players in those markets, as well as the fintech companies that are changing the nature of the industry as well.
The players that are in capital markets, wealth, and trading. So that is a very interesting field, and lots of value to be created there. Now, how do your customers that you work with, how do they talk about the value they get from working with you?
I'd say that customers always look at what we do as being both top line and bottom line oriented. Right. So the idea is that, rather than speak of Rick Speer specifically, that Simon Kucher does is Simon Kucher is excellent at understanding the intersection between supply and demand. So you could argue that all strategy rubber hits the strategy road if you understand the intersection of supply and demand. It was like one of my Stanford professors in business school said, will the dogs eat the dog food? What Simon Kucher says is not will the dogs eat the dog food, but what's the value of the dogs eating the dog food?
Interesting.
And how do you optimize that value?
Yep.
So can you see the value? And once you can see the value, can you create value? And once you create value, can you optimize the value?
You do that for the customers. What is usually their response?
Well, usually they're willing to write checks because they see that the investment's going to have a good return. And they know that we have the pragmatic skills, not just the abstract skills, to be able to make it happen.
The value is actually created. It isn't just a idea. It's actually created. That the rubber is meeting the road and you're creating value for them.
As maybe a reform consultant, you know that we love to produce PowerPoints and we love to produce Excel. That only gets you so far. But it's not that it's not important, but if that's the end result, then we fail.
To do this thing called futures thinking. So no one knows what the future is going to bring, but we can always think about possible futures. So what I would love to do in your field is think out 10 years from now, 2035. What do you see? What does the market look like?
I'll twist this a little bit, as I did before. And I have been working since 1984, as I stated earlier, which means that I have seen 40 years of change. Bezos constantly talks about when you present a plan, don't think about just the things that are variants, but think about the invariants. Right? So it's not just a matter of what's going to change, but also what will not change.
Yeah.
So in the context of 1984 to today, what hasn't changed in asset management, wealth management, and capital markets? And the answer is that they're all very high-paying industries with all tremendously high stakes for customers. The value of money continues to be the most important variable that drives the value of the industry. And so therefore, our ability to be able to make decisions on money and to be able to move money effectively and be able to monetize the value of money is really the same set of drivers. So I do not believe that's going to change 20 years from now. That same core set of underlying value drivers will be the same. Now, how we do it is of course the question everyone wants to know, because technology, the way we do things, has to change. And why is that? We don't have to have a crystal ball for that. Look at how much change has occurred over the past 40 years. And of course, as we know, change is only accelerating, it's not decelerating. So I'd expect that it's incredibly baffling when you think about how much is done in a non-straight through processing fashion across all parts of the industry. I'm not trying to think about it from an operational perspective. I'm thinking about it from a customer to firm interaction or customer market interaction. Who are the end customers and how do they ultimately get the returns they're seeking? Whether they're seeking returns as institutional investors through the capital markets or individual investors through wealth management or asset, and remember that when you think about capital markets, in many ways, it sits right between institutional investors and retail investors. So the idea is that corporations are seeking ways of monetizing the value of their equity or their fixed income. In other words, growing their balance sheets, using their balance sheets. You have asset managers who, of course, are empowering those corporations by buying their debt or buying their equity, whether it's private debt or public debt, private equity or public equity. And then, of course, you have retail investors, could be family offices that are worth $10 billion, or could be an individual who's got $200,000 and is hoping to become a person of wealth at one point. And the interactions that occur today are still incredibly disorganized. one thing that's interesting is that we're going to continue to do more and more things, which adds to chaos. But at the same time, we're going to continue to figure out ways of doing things with a greater level of uniformity. And that greater level of uniformity is going to continue to improve the efficiency of the entire engine, which means we're going to be able to do more with less. So that's my trite view of the future. We're going to continue to do more. We're going to continue with less and less underlying resources to get it done.
That's an interesting way to think about it. So things that stay the same, but things that will also change. Now, if that future becomes reality, what can we do today to get ready for that future?
Well, I think there's things that we can get ready for and things that we can't get ready for. So I'll give you a great example of what we can't get ready for. I was taking a really amazing course at Harvard called the Business Analytics Program, which was founded by the current dean of the business school. That course was a course about AI and the future of how AI was going to change the world. And this was 2019. I took this from 2019 to 2022. And in fact, the professor who led the course, a guy named Professor Karim Lakhani, wrote this book called Competing the Age of AI. And I think it was published in 2021. And you can see it's even signed by Karim. And so they missed ChatGPT because ChatGPT was not yet up and running. So all the prognosticators, if you go back in time and ask them what they thought about ChatGPT, they had nothing to say. But now no one can stop speaking about it. So how do you prepare for step change in technology that even the people who are experts don't see happening? So I'd say that, the trite answer is that we have to become experts in AI. I think the calmer answer is that all of us have to be willing and able to use the best tools available to us. Best tools available to us will evolve. There may be some surprises along the way, right? And that's how we've always prepared. So the way we prepare really hasn't changed. I think that's the more important thing to think about. How does any excellent business person prepare for the future? By staying on top of everything that's going on, by being smart about selecting the best set of tools, by being willing to experiment, by in fact investing in experimentation, by placing a series of smart bets, knowing that you're going to lose some of those bets. And in fact, you have to lose some of those bets. That to me is the way you prepare.
Constant is change, so you got to be ready for it.
Every once in a while, sometimes the constant is constant. There are periods like, for instance, the lack of inflation that occurred, right, post the economic crisis, lulled us into a sense of complacency because, in fact, things weren't changing enough. So sometimes you have to understand that, yeah, you do hit a plateau. I don't think that we're in a period of massive stability over the next 20 years. I think there's going to be a fair amount of change that we're going to deal with. I still think we're very early innings on private equity and private credit. Still think that game hasn't played out fully. I think that the banking system is fundamentally archaic. The whole concept of deposits empowering loans is completely broken. It's been broken. It's old technology. Mutual funds is old technology. These things have to change.
Oh, the one thing I would say is that if change is inevitable, even if we have plateaus, they will never last forever. So it's important to have a advisor that can keep you sharp.
Of course. I'm an invariant. You guys definitely want to bring me on board to help you as you navigate change. And I love to do it. I'd love to work with whoever's out there listening to this podcast.
Well, that's probably a good point to wrap this up on. Thank you very much, Rick, for being on the podcast.
My pleasure, Rutger. Thanks for having me.
Next time, choose to be curious.